Susie, you're starting again. Thank you.
Flap over the religious freedom bill. Is it a liability for the governor? Dan Coats says no to a bid for re-election. What happens next? Eric Holcomb for Senate and Barron Hill on the verge. That plus the school kids who helped create the floor for the Final Four and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 27, 2015. Programming
is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, Mike Pence said that the Religious Freedom Bill is not about discrimination and that if it was, he would have vetoed it. He did, however, exclude the media from the bill signing, evidence that he's losing the public relations battle on this one. In a news conference following that ceremony, he told reporters that contrary to what opponents believe, this is not about gay marriage. Here's the governor, followed by House Minority Leader Scott Pilath.
I know you guys want to take us into that issue. Okay, I've been reading the headlines. I've been watching some of your coverage. But this is about the individual religious liberty of every Hoosier of every faith and the protection against government overreach.
He has pandered to a group that wants to discriminate against others under the phony cover of religious belief.
Did the governor do the right thing? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel, Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Robert Bain, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV State House reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, will this bill still be on the minds of voters in 2016?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. And if you asked if he did the right thing, the answer is no. I mean, if you take what he's saying at face value, that he didn't mean to discriminate, he has a way to fix this. He has damaged the reputation of the state. He has damaged the economic development of this state. I don't want to say irreparably, because the state legislature still has time. He has supermajorities in both houses. All he has to do is put an amendment in there to amend the civil rights statute and include sexual orientation. And then, fine, it's about religious freedom and not about discriminating against gays. And if he means it, that's what he'll do.
Well, he was asked about that, and he said that's not on his agenda. Is he persuadable on that front?
Well, I think what you said at the opening is key, and it's what he said multiple times. If he thought this was about discrimination, he wouldn't sign it. The other thing I think that's important is that the idea that there's some legion of business owners who can't wait for legal sanction to discriminate against customers, that just doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in the other 30 states where this is law.
What does exist is a legion of business owners who are saying they're not sure they want to do business in Indiana now. And that has to be troublesome.
Well, and those are the headlines, right? And I get that. But in the other 30 states, as it was demonstrated by a pro-gay marriage law professor who wrote in the Indianapolis Star, these discrimination horror stories, as the other side is calling them, simply doesn't happen. It doesn't exist. And very quickly, for anyone who wants to try to paint Governor Pence in a separate way, in a discriminatory way. Take a look at what happened at Scott County. Here's a guy, a leader who was against needle exchange his entire career, and he came down there in a public health thing, and he changed his mind and said it's the right thing to
do. But he agreed to it 30 days.
Whoop-de-doo.
And he's working against an amendment General Assembly to make it statewide and permanent. Not to get off track there. Why is this tied to the gay marriage issue, you ask? Before we give you a chance here, John, let's take a look at a photograph from the bill signing. The governor posed at the bill signing with the three most vocal critics of gay marriage, Micah Clark, Eric Miller, and Kurt Smith. Opponents have said that this bill is a consolation prize for those people. This validates their criticism, does it not?
I think so. And if you look back at some of the literature and some of the comments made by some of these individuals, or at least their associates, people who adhere to these or members of these organizations, these lobbying groups, there was a clear message that this was at least part of the agenda, and the timing is hard.
The federal law is 22 years ago. We've gone 22 years with nobody asking for this.
And then
gay marriage passes, and guess what happens?
Yeah. I think it's hard to ignore that timing. It's when you ask about is this good or bad, if you're Mike Pence, I think advising him now, a lot of this is water over the dam, but. It's put him obviously in a horrible position. But if he has any desire to seek the presidency at some point, I'm not sure. Let me say everything here. He didn't really have much choice in terms of satisfying the most conservative wing of the party, the very people who are active in primaries and are active.
So he's pandering, is what you're saying.
So I think this is what he needed to do if he ever wanted to get the nomination. Okay. But would he ever win a general election? Now after this? No.
So he sold Indiana down the river to pander to the radical.
Yeah, John Katzenberger, whatever the motivation here, whatever the political calculus, he's not handled this well on a public relations front.
This bill has been a problem all along for them. From the first hearing where nobody was there to see the vote, all the way through the private signing, it makes it look like the process is ashamed of this bill, like it's trying to pull one over or sneak it through. They have not handled the public relations well at all. They continue not to handle the public relations well. And it has really come home to roost. We've got a plethora of people, companies, all kinds of organizations that have threatened, and some are acting on those threats, to cause economic harm for the city and the state of Indiana. These are very real outcomes, and whether they're unintended consequences or not, it could cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars in investments, tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue, and the loss of prestige as a place where you want to come, live, work, raise a family. I think those are very real concerns. I think that they cause problems for the governor going forward, and I think if next year he's looking at this issue, and hasn't done anything in the interim to fix that perception. And by that, I think he needs to do what Ann's talking about and amend the bill. Then he faces a real prospect of electoral peril next summer.
We've seen Mayor Greg Ballard speak out against this now. Is the potential here for a split in the party as a result of the Religious Freedom Bill?
Well, the mayor was asked specific questions and he gave specific answers. If you believe that Governor Pence, in his heart, signed this to foment some sort of discrimination for the state, for the people in the state, that's simply untrue. He said it multiple times
Do you admit he's got a public relations problem?
I think
here?
That there's obviously a PR storm. There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. But Governor Pence, I believe, has earned the right to be taken at his word. He has met with people. He's called the CEO of Salesforce.
No.
He's talked to people and said, let me tell you what this is about.
Yeah.
In 30 other states, all these horror stories are not happening.
Yeah, the PR horror story is happening in other states.
But the PR doesn't matter in the sense that discrimination claims, the history of, and I work in PR, so that should be the greatest thing ever, right? But the discrimination claims, all these stories, they are not happening. They haven't happened in the 20 plus years after President Clinton
signed
sign the bill.
That's not the objective, is to amend the Civil Rights Act, which he isn't doing, is he? And when you talk about Ballard's statement, that's a profile in cowardice, because he waited when both his party controls both houses. He waited till after it passed and after the governor said he was going to sign it.
Only Ann Delaney thinks a man who spent 23 years in the United States Marine Corps as an officer could be
a
coward.
It was
a
You ought to take that one back. Oh, I don't think so.
I think that...
He called your husband. He called you after your husband got attacked.
That's exactly right.
And he also rejiggered funds so that you could get money for the Julian Center. You owe him an apology. You don't call the mayor a coward.
He could have gone and testified.
Shameful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think getting back on the topic of this conversation, I think that there's an important distinction that needs to be made with regard to this bill. Because I do think that the governor is sincere in his belief that this is not a matter of discrimination. But there are two important changes between this bill and the bills that passed the federal government. And, oh, by the way, it's interesting that Bill Clinton signed it and everybody's making a big deal out of it. It was a bipartisan bill.
Right.
And state laws were the same. The difference is the non-discrimination, it preempts the non-discrimination, and it also incorporates the Supreme Court's definition of an individual as a corporation. Those are major differences that affect the outcome
of the law. How many times have we heard supporters of this bill say, well, Chuck Schumer, liberal senator, when he was in the House,
he was the author in 1993.
Well, Chuck Schumer has said it was a perversion because, as you point out, John, the Supreme Court's interpretation. He said this was never intended when he wrote it in 1993. This was about individual protection of the individual's religious beliefs from government, not for-profit entities and others. A completely different issue.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, how will the Religious Freedom Bill affect Indiana's image? Your choices are A, it will make it appear unwelcoming, B, it will show that constitutional freedoms matter here, or C, no effect. Last week's question, do you feel safe in the statehouse? 43% said yes, 8% said no, 49% said only after the General Assembly goes home. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana Senator Dan Coats announced this week that he won't seek re-election in 2016. He delivered the message to supporters in this video.
While I believe I am well positioned to run a successful campaign for another six-year term, I have concluded that the time has come to pass this demanding job to the next generation of leaders.
Robert Vane, did you see that coming?
Well, not necessarily, no. I mean, there was a lot of hope that he would run. Obviously, as an incumbent, as a popular senator, he would have been almost impossible to beat. He's actually the first person I ever worked for when I started in politics and stuffing envelopes in 1992. There is no nicer man in Indiana politics. He's been a terrific senator. He's a terrific person. It's going to be a big loss.
Open seat, Democrats are chomping at the bit.
Oh, no question about it. It's about time we had a senator that represented Indiana. I mean, you've had Dan Coats in there years before in Congress and the Senate and 4.5 years there now, and his biggest accomplishment is what he didn't do. He's one of the few Republican senators who didn't sign the letter to Iran, and that's the most noteworthy thing of the 4.5 years he spent there. So, yeah, they're chomping at the bit, particularly in a presidential year when the potential for the Republicans to nominate somebody to the radical right is substantial.
Well, his not signing that letter, a couple of weeks ago on this set, we said that was an indication that he may not run.
He obviously had to be considering this for some time. That's the kind of a decision that may or may not, but I think probably did, reveal some of his thinking. It was the right thing not to do, to involve the Congress in the act of foreign policy, as he knew as a former ambassador, is not the right thing to do. And so he did the right thing.
John,
and because of that, he wasn't going to seek re-election, because if he didn't do the right thing,
I mean, be careful
how you put that, because he does deserve credit for not signing.
Absolutely, and okay. I don't think that's the only reason he did it. I'm sorry, and if that's the impression I left, that's not intentional. But I do think that that was probably part of his thinking.
Probably.
All right, John Schwanes, do you agree with him that he was in position to win re-election?
Yeah, I think he would have won. This is somebody who has... you don't see this very often anymore, where you have somebody who can navigate through both sides of the political spectrum within his own party, which is probably tougher now than
navigating. As part of the establishment,
he is seen as part. He was the establishment candidate. Yeah. Remember when he was recruited to run, and yet he beat what could be described as Tea Party favorites at the time because he has been able, and everybody's touched on this. It's sort of old school in the sense that it's almost a civility that sadly, we're losing a lot of as you look at some of the retirement announcements in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. So it's I take him at his word. It's an issue of wanting to do something with his years, passing the torch to a new generation. And, yeah, it probably isn't much fun being in the U.S. Senate right now. It's hard to get much
fun. The fact that he was in the majority makes it somewhat surprising.
Yeah. To the Republican field now. Former Indiana Republican Party Chairman Eric Holcomb is the first to formally announce his candidacy for the Coates seat. Holcomb can expect lots of company in the GOP field in 2016. He quit his job as top aide to Senator Coates to make the run and has never sought statewide office before.
And I'm asking every Hoosier who feels the way I do, who has a shared responsibility and duty, who feels that, returning America to our rightful and respected position in the world to join me.
John Katzenberger, will Eric Holcomb be a contender?
Oh, absolutely. I think you could look at him as the front runner. I think, given his service as the state party chair in the senator's office, somebody's got contacts all around the state, he has great personal credentials, I think he'll be the front runner. But he will not be the only candidate.
Yeah, he's low name ID for starters, but he's worked for Mitch Daniels. He's been party chair. He's been around the state, got a lot of contacts within the party.
Well, that's why I would say to your comment about low name ID. Low name ID maybe with the general public, not low name ID with the Republican organization and with grassroots volunteers and funders and contributors. I think there because of his service as state chair and his role as chief of staff to the senator. His credentials are very well known. I agree. I think time is of the essence here. I mean, and the fact that he was...
And then it appears Dan Coates tried to give him a head start.
Right. I mean, even though the senator was careful not to effectively endorse anyone, he did say some pretty lavish, quite a bit of praise on Eric Holcomb. So I think... he was smart to do it when he did. I mean, why wait a week? Do it.
Okay,
do it
lots of it. Others. Todd Young says he's looking at it. Susan Brooks says she's looking at it. State Senator Mike Delf is looking at it. Marlon Stutzman's looking at it.
Robert Bain.
No.
How big will this primary be?
Well, it kind of depends on who can lock up some initial support. When someone gets in early and they get the money headed this way and the endorsements headed this way, I mean, John's exactly right. Holcomb has an impressive resume, especially for a primary. The working for Mitch Daniels, state chair, and not only that, he has the same reputation within the party that Dan Coates does. He can talk to the folks who are a little bit more conservative.
He's going to be the establishment, and
he's a convener. That's for sure. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And he has a huge following of people who just think he's a terrific guy because he is.
Okay, looks like a Republican free for all.
It does, and I think it will be. And on top of that, like we said in the primary for the congressional district that Susan Brooks won, you put four guys in suits and one skirt. The skirt wins.
You think Susan Brooks is the
favorite? I think she's going to be formidable, and I think it's going to be. He may have party organization support, but she's going to have grassroots support, and I think that makes a big difference.
If anyone else who gets in who could make a difference, Ann's exactly right. It's Susan Brooks. She's extremely well-liked.
To the Democrats, Democrat Barron Hill has run for the Senate once before, and the former Democratic congressman is also sounding like a candidate now that Coates is departing the scene. I reached Hill by phone.
The only thing that would hold me back is the quality time with the three grandchildren that I have, which I will miss. But other than that, I'm getting a lot of encouragement from both family members and friends.
She wins.
John Schwanes, can Barron Hill clear the field on the Democratic side?
I think he has a shot at doing so. Early on, there was a lot of speculation. Oh, maybe Evan Bayh sitting on his $10 million left over from his last
9.9.
9.9, but hey, somebody will make up the difference.
Yeah.
But, now clearly there was a dampening of those thoughts and that conversation.
Well, Dan Parker, serving as spokesman for Evan Bayh, has said he's not interested.
Well, what he says is he's not a candidate.
Are you going to throw Ann in the mix since you threw me in the other side?
Oh, sure. Ann can be in the mix, no, too. But I do think if anybody has the potential, and Brad Ellsworth, you know, who ran and was a nominee last time that Dan Coats, or when Dan Coats won this time around. But I think Baron Hill, again, name ID, the intimate knowledge of the power structure and the organization within the state, probably has as good a shot of clearing the field as anybody.
Well, Baron Hill has been traveling the state, talking to Democratic groups, sounding like he was looking to run for governor,
right?
As well as John Gregg. If he chooses to run for the Senate, this solves a big potential problem for the Democrats.
Well, certainly would slot people in a way that would avoid a primary, and for the Democrats, that's probably important. They don't want to, they can't afford to have the acrimony if there is any, and they, you know, need to shepherd the dollars that they have. And the other thing is that's important to consider is that while you have a lot of Republicans, you also have a lot of Republicans already in office. I think a lot of the Democrats who might think about this have to think about where they are right now in office and whether they want to give those offices up because they just don't have as many as the Republicans do. And so they carry more weight within the structure. And, you know, you don't want to just take a flyer. You got to know what you're doing.
And so many of the Republicans, to his point, some of the Republicans who are thinking about it are newcomers to politics or newcomers to elective office. And a lot of what you're seeing on the Democrat side is the fact they've been losing all these races, so they're trying to bring people back. That's a huge advantage, especially for us, because we've already done, for these candidates, they've already got a fundraising process and all that stuff going.
Yeah, it's an advantage from that point of view. But the other point of view is every one of those congressmen who are sitting in a seat now have to give it up in order to run for the Senate. So that makes for free-for-all all the way down the road. Christina Hale's name's been mentioned for this, too. I think Barron's a strong candidate, and certainly Christina would be as well.
Scott Pelas been mentioned, too, and he hasn't ruled it out.
Yeah. And, you know, on the Republican side, too, we forgot to mention Brian Bosma and David Long, both of whom have been mentioned for the possible
Brian Bosma says he's focusing on the General Assembly.
Well, that'll be over in another month.
He's officially not considering at this point, but he hasn't closed the door. Let's go back to Evan Bayh. The fact that, he's the first name everybody mentions, the first place everybody turns. He's got $9.9 million. For him not to come back, now, does that effectively mean that he's never going to run for office from Indiana again?
Yes.
So the Evan Bayh era is over?
I believe it is, yes.
Is that bothersome?
He's
been a huge figure in Indiana politics.
Is that to me?
wouldn't be from Robert.
No?
Well, I mean, he's obviously a winner. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He's a winner, so that's the first person you look for, just like there's a lot of people who are looking, for example, who mentioned Todd Rokita, simply because he's won statewide twice. That makes a huge difference when you've already built up that ID.
I don't think Todd Rokita has much of a statewide ID.
Well, I think it's to everybody's point. I think Holcomb was smart to get out first, very smart.
Okay, so looking at 2016, open seat, we don't know who the nominees will be. Is it, at this point, we got to figure that it leans Republican.
It always leans Republican in Indiana, but an open seat is a much better target, and you're in a presidential year, which is a much better year to be in from a Democratic perspective, and I don't underestimate the ability of the Republican Party to nominate somebody who's not going to be mainstream. I don't underestimate that at all. I mean, if you have a Ted Cruz or a Scott Walker or
a Richard Murdoch.
What about Richard Murdoch for Senate? You know,
heard it mentioned.
No.
Maybe he's redeemed himself.
What about it?
Maybe he's learned his lesson.
I mean, if we do, I mean, I am the Republican on the panel. We have an embarrassment of riches. We have several potential extremely good candidates.
We have a
wealth of riches here.
And as long as we're hashing through this, Mike Pence ruled it out almost immediately. I mean,
in my text to you.
Yeah, thank you. I was protecting the source.
one thing, though.
I do work for him, so I might as well be honest.
You made the suggestion a few minutes ago that the Republicans are in a better position, though, because they have people who are in the fray right now. They can kind of step right into it, the notion of a deep bench, whereas Democrats are having to sort of reach into the past and pull somebody in. Wasn't that what the Republican Party did with Dan Coats?
Exactly.
But it was a hugely positive Republican year. And what the Republicans have going for them that Barron Hill does not is the fact that they all have active political organizations. It makes a huge difference when you're trying to recruit volunteers and raise money.
It's different than an off-year election.
Big winner here at the Indiana Week in Review panel. We got things to talk about for a year and a half. Finally, the basketball floor that will be the scene of the NCAA championship game arrived here this week. First stop, Riverside Junior High School in Fishers, where the eighth graders helped create it. Back in January, hundreds of students at the school started collecting used water bottle caps. That plastic was shipped off to Michigan and recycled into the plastic anchors that will hold the floor together. Here's eighth grader H.L. Lewis.
It's really cool. Just to know that like, I helped build the court, it feels really good.
It's pretty much like a once-in-a-lifetime chance that our school is going to be able to do this.
Robert Vane, who thought of that?
I don't know, whoever did, they're brilliant. It's just like Allison Melangdon or whoever came up with the idea to have the kids deliver the Super Bowl bids. Just brilliant.
Are we losing, is the Final Four the thrill here that it used to be?
Oh, I think it is. And I think it's great that the kids put the time and effort into that. I'm all for the recycling. Just too bad Governor Pence isn't.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Robert Vane, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR or starting Monday. You can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T, rethink possible.